everyone. I'm Andrea Ferretti, and this is Yogaland. Today, my guest is Brett Larkin. In all likelihood, you are familiar with Brett Larkin because she has a huge online presence. She has over 500,000 YouTube followers. She's been online for more than a decade, and she's been teaching yoga teacher training for more than a decade as well. In fact, she loves to tell the story about her students asking her to create a yoga teacher training online. And it was so long ago that Yoga Alliance did not yet accredit the training. And she said, oh, I'm not allowed to. But they encouraged her and she did. So she was very, very early on in the space. I will say you can look at Brett and say to yourself, oh my gosh, she is just a pretty petite young blonde woman. It must have all been so easy for her. You can kind of have that preconceived notion. And if you have that preconceived notion, I really encourage you to listen to this interview because she is hands down one of the hardest working people I have ever spoken to on the podcast. And she's really bright and knows her stuff. I've listened to her podcast before I prepared for this one. And she studied for a long time with Alan Finger. She knows what she's doing. So I think that it's really helpful to listen to people who have, you know, achieved this quote unquote huge amount of yoga fame, to hear how hard and uncertain it was in the beginning. And one of the things that she's very honest about is that she kept her job as a game developer for a very long time as she was developing her online teaching business. She was definitely working two full jobs at the same time while mothering, might I add. So it's really encouraging and a good look behind the curtain to see that no one's path is straight and certain. And in all likelihood, everybody works hard, right? So I think you'll enjoy that aspect of her. She's very down to earth too. We also talk about her book today. She's got a new book out called Yoga Life, Habits, Poses, and Breathwork to Channel Joy Amidst the Chaos. And this is a great book for developing your own home practice. It's packed with information. I wish I'd had it, I'd say about 15 years ago, when I had a hard time with the idea that if I wasn't doing an hour of yoga in a studio or in my work classes all the time, I wasn't quote unquote doing enough. I wasn't practicing long enough. I wasn't practicing hard enough. I wasn't focused enough. I wasn't structured enough. So this book really gives you permission to do what works for you while also offering structures to create a complete practice with the time that you have. So I know you're going to enjoy the interview. Can't wait to hear what you think. And I would be remiss if I did not, with all of this talk about YouTube, if I did not mention Jason's YouTube channel. He has been posting there for a little over a year. So if you haven't seen it, go check it out and like and follow and subscribe and do all those YouTube things that YouTubers do. He posts a lot of additional podcast videos. His yoga teacher's companions are there. And go follow Brett as well. Okay, enjoy the interview. Well, hi there, Brett Larkin. It's so nice to finally meet you and to have you on the show.
I'm so thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
You are such a rock star and you have been rocking the online space for quite a while. So I, you know, looked up all your stats and of course you were so organized and sent a lot of information to me as well. And you have 500,000 YouTube subscribers now. Like that is crazy. How does that feel? How long did it take? When did you start your YouTube channel?
I started my YouTube channel in 2012. And what was really interesting is I thought I was late at the time. I thought YouTube was like already peaked and over. And it turns out I was still part of the wave of the earliest adopters in terms of putting yoga on YouTube. And it's really funny how all of it came about because I started putting yoga on YouTube because I was too intimidated to teach yoga in real life or go to a studio and try to get a job. So it's very serendipitous the way the universe works.
That's amazing. I would have never guessed that about you because you do have such a natural online presence and a natural presence behind the camera and and podcasts. So I actually really appreciate that you shared that, because I think people struggle so often with feeling like everybody else has it together. And that is a really, I would never have guessed that in a million years.
Yes, I was so intimidated. I was living in San Francisco at the time. So I was attending the class of incredible people like Jason, for example, and others. And I was working a full-time tech job. I didn't have the confidence to teach in real life. I also thought that if I committed to teaching yoga, I'd be committing to a life of destitute, essentially, like something out of a Dickens novel. I didn't know any yoga teachers really who made money. So in addition to imposter syndrome, I just had all these doubts and self-limiting beliefs about money as well.
Yes, which I think is actually a reasonable concern as well. And it's awesome and impressive that that has not been the case, because I think it can be a hard career to make a living doing. So we'll get to that. But what would you say? So you said you were, well, first of all, why don't you share how you discovered yoga? You share that in your new book. And I think it's a really cute story. So, and I always love to kind of start at the beginning with people.
Yes. So I had a lot of anxiety growing up, and in my teens, I danced. So I love dance. I was constantly going to dance camps and not competitions, but I was used to having to film myself to get into different dance programs. So this is important for the story later, because I had some familiarity with the idea of, like, you know, okay, I'm going to set up a camera and do some choreography in front of it. So that was sort of a skill. In college, I met someone who was saying, you know, you really like dance, you really like Pilates, like, why don't you try yoga? And I just said, why would I do that? Yoga's for wimps. Like, that was literally my impression of what yoga was. I was like, that's for people who just want to relax and are kind of wet noodles and don't have the strength to dance, for example. And this friend got me into meditation. So I started dabbling, and I realized that there was maybe something there. And then I said, okay, I'll try yoga, but only if it's the most intense kind, right? Because I was extremely competitive and type A. And that's how I found myself in Soho, New York, at Bikram Yoga Studios, literally competing with people in the mirror. I was trying to get my leg higher than the lady in the front row. And it was natural for me to push myself that hard. It was burning off a layer of anxiety, which was great. But because I have high pitta, and I talk about this in the book, kind of personalizing your yoga to your dosha or your dominant dosha, it was actually kind of a catastrophic combination. So I'd leave those classes in one sense feeling great, but then I like couldn't get off the couch the rest of the day. Right? It was too far in the other direction. And then I was thinking, okay, maybe I'll try some traditional yoga studios, but I was too intimidated. So I turned to the internet, and lo and behold, who do I find on yogajournal.com? Your husband, Jason. And I just fell in love with, like, this little, it was a 10, 20 minute routine that he had on there. And I did it every day for like a year. It was insane. I just was addicted to this routine. My friends in college were making fun of me because I was even bringing, like, the yoga mat on, like, spring break and all these trips where people were supposed to be, like, partying and having fun. I was like, sorry, I need to leave right now to go do, like, my 20-minute Jason Crandall online yoga video. So, of course, that led to, like, falling in love with yoga and trying all the different studios and all the different styles in New York, and eventually training in New York under Alan Finger, who owns and operates, or used to, Ishta Yoga. He's also the original co-founder of Yoga Works, which used to be a huge yoga chain. So that's kind of the origin story.
That's amazing. I mean, and I totally relate and recognize the going to Bikram classes, looking in the mirror and comparing yourself. I mean, I kind of think that's what the mirrors were for in a lot of ways. I know that technically the mirrors are supposed to be for checking your alignment and all those things, but those of us who were dancers growing up, the mirrors can be really dangerous. The mirrors are really a challenge for me. And I noticed that even now in a lot of, if I go to yoga, there's a teacher I really like at our local gym, and sometimes she'll let me come as her guest. And there's still mirrors there. And I'm like, oh, it's really a challenge for me. And I can also relate to it feeling so good in the moment and then feeling just absolutely burnt out and exhausted for the rest of the day, which is, you know, as you learn more about yoga, and you talk about this so much in your book, but the idea is to work with your constitution and with yourself and, like, to personalize it, not to keep, like, enforcing those like those habits of competition and those like dark spots. So, all right. So you got into yoga and then you started studying with Alan Finger. Obviously you did your teacher training, but you were too into, you still had your full-time job. When did you make the transition to out of, you know, your desk job to teaching full-time?
Not for so long. Mm-hmm. Not until 2014, maybe 2015. I remember I was running my first yoga teacher training online and still working the desk job. I mean, originally I had a job that I loved. I created dance and movement fitness games at Ubisoft. So if you've ever played like Just Dance or some of those fun dance games that were popular back in the day when Wii Fit and Kinect just came out. But then that bubble kind of burst and like then the new thing was like Farmville and all these like social games. And my role kind of, you know, ended up shifting and I wasn't as happy. And that's when I was kind of moonlighting, putting these videos on YouTube because I was too scared to teach in person. I, you know, was working in an office during the week. So it just seemed like something I could do on my time and my schedule. The first video I uploaded because I had just moved from New York to San Francisco and I was really missing a lot of my Ishta teachers. And I had kind of created a sequence that I loved that was reminding me of that style and lineage. And I was like, you know, I really want to remember this sequence. And so I ended up filming it and putting it on YouTube, not even really thinking people would watch it per se. Mm-hmm. And then when people started watching and commenting, I was like, oh, maybe I should upload another one. Mm-hmm. You know, slowly I was building this muscle of video recording and uploading as a form of expression and as a form to, you know, remember sequencing that I really liked. And ultimately that gave me the confidence. It took a year or two, but then to actually start teaching in San Francisco at studios. And then I got to teach at every studio that I had ever wanted to teach at, but I was always still working the full-time job.
Wow.
So yeah, I kept it a really long time, a lot out of fear. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, the YouTube channel wasn't really bringing in a lot of revenue at that point, and it wasn't clear to me like how this was going to become a business still. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And so I know that you teach online trainings and you've done that for a long time. You're really a pioneer in that space. Was it deciding to do the training where you realized you could actually, you know, make a living doing this, and that did the YouTube channel then feed into the training?
Yes, the YouTube channel and the membership site. So before the training, I created a yoga app, which now seems like duh, you know, everyone has that. But back in 2014,
I
was very early, like not a lot of people had a yoga app. And I have to credit a lot of YouTuber friends that I kind of networked with who told me, they were like, you should start a membership site. And I kept saying, why? Like, why would people pay for like Netflix yoga with me when they can just do it for free on YouTube? It literally didn't make any sense to me. I was like, this won't work. But I had other YouTubers and friends telling me like, yes, this model does work. So I launched a membership site, which is the Uplifted Yoga Membership. It still exists. And once I launched it, I was still at my full-time job. I remember like kind of assembling the membership site, like on the DL in meetings and stuff like that. And then I just was like, I need to get my first 100 members. I really just became a dog with a bone, like very focused on like, I'm getting 100 members into this site. And one of the things that helped me was I switched jobs. So I switched to a job in kind of the yoga Ayurveda space that allowed me to work remote. So that's a great tip I have for people who are like doing the career transition. Cause I was like, how can I work for a company that is going to help me meet people and learn information that will support me when I'm a full-time yoga teacher? Mm-hmm. And obviously I really wanted something remote, which again was unusual back in the day, right? We have to remember this is 2014, but that gave me a lot of flexibility because now on my lunch break, I could go live on Periscope. If anyone remembers that app.
Oh my gosh.
I know Instagram, Periscope. Facebook did not have live streaming at this point, y'all. So I was doing it on Periscope and I would just go live like constantly and just talk to people about yoga. I was talking to people about yoga on my Facebook group, in the comments of my YouTube videos, and I was just very focused. I was like, anything someone told me they needed help with, I'd just make a video for it. Mm-hmm. So I was just very engaged with what became my community. And then I got those first 100 Uplifted members, and it was so exciting.
That's awesome. I think what's so neat about your story is that it seems like it really fused your natural skill set and that you really leveraged that, like you said, at a time where you were really a pioneer. You didn't know. It reminds me of Tara Stiles too, who's really, really early on YouTube. Like, you didn't know what would come of it, but it sounds like it suited. Would you say that it has suited your personality to really transition to fully digital space for your
Absolutely.
Teaching?
I love making videos. And I mean, when I was 9 and 8 years old, I was making videos. Like I begged my dad to get me this little, it wasn't even a camcorder. I don't know what it was, but something. And I'd make these videos with my troll dolls. Do you remember the troll dolls that have the hair that goes straight up?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was really into those. So I was making, you know, like epic movies with all these troll dolls. My father really instilled a spirit of entrepreneurship in me from a very young age. So if I was like into filmmaking, he was like, great. You know, he was helping me figure out how to edit little videos, or he was just extremely supportive. Mm-hmm. And I, to this day, it was just before coming to talk to you today, I was like, oh, I wish I could film a video today. Like, I just love the process. And I think if you're listening to this and you're a yoga teacher, it's like, what lights you up? You know, I think a lot of people graduating from my teacher trainings, and I'm sure from your guys' community as well, like they feel this pressure to have to be on every platform immediately. Mm-hmm. And it's so overwhelming. And I think if you just pick what you love, like pick one thing you love and lean into it, that's where the power is, because being a teacher is challenging, right? You're your own boss. You're your own marketing team. You're your own, you know, there's so much discomfort in putting yourself out there. So if you can infuse at least as much as you can, something that you love. So like if you love Instagram as a platform, like leading with that, you know, I love YouTube as a platform. So I've leaned into that. If you love teaching in person or leading small women's circles or, you know, teaching at festivals, like really following your bliss in that way, I think is so critical because it makes all the harder aspects of entrepreneurship feel worth it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so smart. And I was actually going to ask you that exact question. Like there are so many different options now. And I think people feel splintered, understandably. And I always offer the same advice. Pick one or maybe two things that you really want to do. I mean, that's what's going to fuel you to keep doing it. And, you know, honestly, you are prolific. I mean, you remind me of Jason creating content. Like you are prolific with creating content. When you go to your YouTube channel, it's like thousands of videos. Like that's amazing. And so clearly you can't do that if you don't enjoy it. It's not worth it. It's just absolutely not worth it.
Yeah. And it's like, maybe you love writing, right? Like maybe you love writing about yoga and you want to start a blog. Like, again, I think really looking at what your innate skill set is and what lights you up instead of trying to shoehorn yourself into this vision of having like every platform and because that's just a recipe for burnout.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think another thing that's really unique and special about you is that it feels to me, and it has felt to me for several years, like for lack of a better word, like your brand message is really, really clear. Like you are very warm, you are very nurturing, and you make things really clear and accessible. And at the same time, you have like a deep yoga background. Like you've really done your study and you know, you're very knowledgeable. Did you decide when you started the channel, did you have that clear vision of exactly what you wanted to convey and how you wanted to convey it? Or did it come over time?
It came over time. Mm-hmm. I think this is important to tell everyone because it's like you can't intellectualize your way there, right? Or it's almost like, you know, how we talk about yoga. It's like we're removing the obstacles, right? In order to get to the bliss body and who we really are. It's like peeling back those layers of the onion. It's the same journey with your business, right? It's like your messaging and your core values are only going to be revealed by getting into action and making a lot of mistakes as well and like trial and error over time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can't tell you how many times I have either my graduates or other yoga teachers be like, I'm rebranding, I'm launching a website and redoing the website. And they think it's like this be all end all. And like, meanwhile, I know I'm like, you're going to want to redo it in 2 years. You're going to want to redo it. Like, you know, it's this constant evolution. Mm-hmm. So I really work to just try to not be perfectionistic, which is difficult because I am a perfectionist, mm-hmm. but be in the flow of like, this brand is evolving and I'm in co-creation with my community. Mm-hmm. I think that's like the biggest tip and lesson that I love to share with other yoga teachers is like, I didn't figure any of this out by myself. I have really listened to my community. Even putting yoga teacher training online was not my idea. My community came to me from once I had that Uplifted membership. They said, we want to train with you online. Mm. And I said, well, that's cool, but Yoga Alliance doesn't approve like online yoga. This is, you know, 2014. Mm-hmm. You can't. and then they kept asking for it. They were like, no, we really want to. We really. And I remember I used to go to this gym in the Sunset in the Bay Area, because we both know that space. I'd be at my gym in like the inner Sunset on the elliptical. And I'd just think when I was on the elliptical, I'd be like, could I do this? Like, could I put yoga teacher training online? Like, what would that even look like? You know, mm-hmm. like what were the parts of my yoga teacher training that I think would be really well suited to like lecture style videos as opposed to, you know, interacting, and could we teach live on Zoom? And I mean, it's hysterical because for 5 years, I had a week or two built into training, teaching people how to use Zoom because no one was using it. Like it was, no one knew what it was. It's like 2020 hit. And like, we got to remove that whole portion from our syllabus because people had been to like a Zoom birthday party earlier that day. It just became like commonplace, but it was just really mind-boggling to me. Like, will this work? Will people actually want it? How do I do it? But because I listened to the folks who were telling me they wanted it, I took a leap of faith and built what turned out to be the first online yoga teacher training. Now I have a couple different trainings, but that first 200-hour one. And it was scary. Yeah. I had to spend a lot of money to film everything and fly experts in. And I didn't know if it was going to work. And I was still working my full-time job.
Wow. You are a hard worker. Oh my gosh. I mean, anyone who has kind of reached the level of success that you have is a hard worker, period. But to know that you were still working your full-time job and creating a 200-hour training like boggles my mind. That's pretty amazing. But you said two really important things that I want to kind of call out. One is, you know, you conveyed this necessity of being flexible with your business. And I could not agree more. I mean, so many times people will ask me like, what exact content should I create to, you know, attract my students and to grow my classes and things like that. And I can give you some frameworks, but I always tell people like, don't get frustrated if in 2 months or 3 months, you know, this isn't working. Look at what the data is showing you. Listen to your intuition and be flexible and adapt. Like, you constantly have to adapt when you're a small business owner. And I think the sooner you learn that, the more you avoid like the frustration and giving up, right? Like, oh, this is all supposed to be perfect and I must not be doing it right. It's like, no, this is kind of how it goes. You have to just kind of listen and adapt. So I appreciate that you pointed that out. And then the other thing is, it's really, really cool that you, like you said, you're co-creating with your community. And I think that's brilliant. I hadn't quite thought of it that way. Do you feel like, I mean, you said it was scary. Were there some self-limiting beliefs that came into play with putting out that first training online?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, all the things like, who am I to put out a training? You know, do I know enough? I'm just this blonde girl. Like, who's going to listen to me? You know, like all of the things. But I think what helped me was having that community or a couple people. I mean, this is not a lot of people at this point, everyone listening. This is, you know, like 5 or 10 people in my Facebook group who are telling me like, no, we really, really want this from you. And you know, just that dare to dream. You know, at that point, I was like, if I can make a living, and I was willing to make very little money. I was like, if I can even just make like half my, you know, corporate or desk job salary mm-hmm. and only have to do yoga, like that for me was the dream. Mm-hmm. You know, that was my vision. And it's just so funny because my, you know, my now husband and I, we even talked about it. And I was like, okay, I could just do yoga and then be a mom. You know, flash forward, it's like I employed him in my business now for 2 years.
Nice.
Not anymore. Like I've had a team of as many as 15 people. Now we're more like 10. But, you know, the business has been more profitable and more beautiful than like my wildest dreams. But that at that moment, that was my only goal.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So that's a huge team of people to employ and delegate. At what point did things kind of shift where it went from like, okay, I've got 5 or 10 people. I'm doubting myself. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going to keep doing this. When did things kind of kick into a completely different gear?
2015, things started to change. Mm-hmm. The membership was doing well. You know, it went from like that first 100 members to just like more and more members. I mean, mm-hmm. again, it still exists. That's the same membership. Obviously, I've added so much more content, but the fundamental thing is the same, right? And now we have thousands of members. The first online yoga teacher training cohort, which I believe was in 2015, was so exciting because I was just seeing, is this going to work? Right? Like, is this whole weird Zoom, me mailing them a manual, them watching videos, us doing stuff on Zoom, like, is this all going to work and fit together? And I think I maybe had 30 or 40 people in that first cohort, which was much more than I thought I would get. Maybe it was as high as 50. No, I think it was probably like 40. Mm-hmm. And that's when like, I just saw it all coming together. I was like, this works. And then I think the next cohort after that was like 100 people. And then it took off because no one was in the space at the time. It was me. And there was one other woman, and that's it, doing online yoga teacher training for 5 years, 2015 to 2020. Mm-hmm. We were the only two options. And her offering was quite different from the way I ran mine, which is a live group cohort model. It's the same way I run it today because I love the friendships and the interaction. To me, it's essential to move through with the same peers from start to finish. Mm-hmm. So yeah, then we saw it really take off and my husband was like, what? And oh, this is also a fun fact. I never gathered the guts to quit the full-time job. They eventually fired me, I think right before yoga teacher training cohort one happened. But I mean, I think that just shows like what a scaredy cat I still was at that time. I think at that point, I think I was wanting to quit and my husband was still uncomfortable with it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Makes sense. We have to make reasonable choices along the way. And I understand, I completely understand that. Jason and I are pretty risk averse as well. I want to ask you one more question about sort of the YouTube space and content development. And then I want to talk about your book, but this is a question that was asked of us recently. And that is, you know, the question was, what if I feel behind, right? Like, I haven't even started yet. You create so much content every week. I feel like I'm never going to be able to get there. What do I do? Is it just all too late?
Well, I think that's all subjective because as I said, I felt too late when I started in 2012. So I think, you know, like the story of I'm too late is a really seductive story because it kind of just abdicates you from taking action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I would just really use like the yoga of awareness to, you know, notice that thought and to lean into what you do love. I mean, when I'm so much of what's fun about entrepreneurship to me is like having the ability to choose energy generating activities, right? So for me, like filming a video or doing something that lights me up generates more prana shakti, right? Like that generates more energy. And then that gives me energy to deal with the hard things that are inevitably going to come my way. Like it was just 1099 season for goodness sake, right? We have taxes coming up and all the things. So to me, that I'm too late story is like a narrative that's keeping you safe and preventing you from taking action. If you could change that story to like, how can I share something that will help someone else mm-hmm. in a way that feels authentic to me, in a way that will light me up? And again, who cares if you're early or late? I think shifting into that place of service is like the biggest thing to help slay imposter syndrome. Because imposter syndrome is very much like about me. Like, what are they going to think of me? Will they like my class? Is the industry going to think I'm early or late? Or, you know, like it's just all this bleh, like garbage. Mm-hmm. When you shift into like, how can I help another person? What service can I offer? I don't I don't know. I think that's the energy that you want to lean into, because then maybe it is a little, you know, late for YouTube if we were looking at like industry statistics, right? YouTube is not growing the way it used to. Not for me, not for any of the big channels. Like I talk to all the big yoga fitness channels. Like we're friends. Like we all share stats. Like it's more challenging to grow than it was years ago. Mm-hmm. But we do see growth happening on other platforms, right? Like TikTok or short form content on Instagram, or, you know, we're seeing a new resurgence of interest in like long form written content, like all these Medium blogs and things that are popping up as people get tired of, you know, the like 5 second culture of swiping that we're in. Mm-hmm. So just shifting into that place of service, I know, is always just so helpful for me. I know it's not like a direct answer to your question, but
no, I think it's great. I mean, it's, I think that combination, like you said, of how can you help people and then take the action so that you can figure out what your authentic voice and offering is. You know, I very much appreciate that you sharing that you didn't know right away how I think what you do is so clearly defined right now, which is incredibly helpful for people when they're looking for a yoga teacher, but you didn't know that in the beginning. The way you learned that was to do it, to keep doing it and to have that sense of perseverance and persistence.
Yeah. It's all a process of trial and error. Yeah. So you need to be willing to fail. I mean, I have a whole module in my 300 training called Fail Fast. Like that's the goal, is just to fail as quickly as possible so you can find the results that you need, or to help people or help someone understand the value of what you're offering and to not take the quote unquote failure personally, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean anything about you. It doesn't mean anything about your teaching. It just means you maybe haven't found the right offer to the right type of student yet that's clicking. I call that the product market fit, right? So it's so easy, especially because as yoga teachers, I think we're so empathetic and we're so sensitive. Many of us are highly sensitive. So we can get down on ourselves really easily or take things personally. Mm-hmm. But I really try to not take business personally, right? Mm-hmm. If someone doesn't like my class, I don't think it's because of me. I think maybe they need a different teacher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really smart. Yeah. That's nice. I'm glad you're out there supporting people and in making that realization, because we all need that support, especially when we're first starting out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So Brett, I want to talk a little bit about your book. Is this your first book?
It is.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations. That's so exciting. It's called Yoga Life, Habits, Poses, and Breathwork to Channel Joy Amidst the Chaos. And I know this book took you at least 3 years to write. And that is all the more impressive because you have a three-year-old now, so I am amazed that you did this while raising a little guy. It's a little boy, right?
Yes, and I have an older son as well, so it's fun.
Yeah. So one of the key points in the book is creating a practice that is your very own and that is adaptable to you and customized to you. And I'm sure as a mom of two and working from home and running your own business, you're become really adept at this. Is that what motivated you to write the book?
Yes. The impetus for the book came because I went through this really wild year where I lost my father to cancer and I was his sole care provider and gave birth to my first son. All in a 12-month period, all while Uplifted Yoga was kind of in a scaling process and growing rapidly. So I literally in my home, if you can visualize this, in Berkeley, I had my infant in one bedroom and my dad on hospice care in the bedroom right next to him. Wow. So the demands on my time were unlike anything I'd ever experienced, right? Like crossing the threshold into being a first-time mom, but then also having my father who was essentially going through like an infantilization process, right? As he exited his physical body, it was just so incredibly intense. And I began to feel like a fraud during this period because I couldn't practice the yoga that I was used to doing. You know, like my ideal practice at that point would be like 60 minutes, 90 minutes, maybe with Jason on Yoga Glow or Kia, you know, like, or my own practice, but like very long, often going to studios, teaching at studios. I couldn't do any of that anymore. And the way I practiced during that time was that I would set a timer on my phone for however long I had. And sometimes it was 5 minutes, sometimes it was 20, sometimes it was 15. But I began to just throw out the yoga rule book and tune deeply inward. And it's kind of like necessity is the mother of invention, because I had so little time. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm just going to tune in and do what I think is going to nourish and fill me up. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to worry about the proper warm up or the proper sequencing. Or I was doing a lot of Kundalini yoga at that time, which, if people don't know, like, there's a lot of rules about what you're supposed to wear, what time you're supposed to practice, how you're supposed to chant at the beginning, you know, just a lot of rules. So I felt kind of like a rebel. I was like, am I going to get in trouble? Like, are the yoga police going to like bang down my door here in Berkeley? Because if they knew what I was doing, because I was combining yoga styles as well. I was like combining Kundalini and yin. I was just doing my own thing. Right. And I'll never forget that one day I was doing this type of like highly personalized, weird practice. And I was very stressed coming into it because it was an extremely stressful year. And I remember feeling really grounded, really having that yoga glow. And, you know, just that profound peace that yoga offers us. And I thought, wow. And then I realized my timer hadn't gone off. So first I was like, oh crap. I was like, my phone died. Like, I'm late for something. And then I looked and I had actually gotten to that state in 16 minutes. Wow. I had set a 20 minute timer for that day. Mm-hmm. And I knew in that moment, I was like, wow, I feel as good after a 16 minute highly personalized practice than I do after a 60-minute group class. How is that possible? And I didn't have the time in that moment to figure it out. But I was like, this is really interesting. I'm going to figure this out. And when I figure it out, I'm going to create a framework around it so other people can figure this out. And that's what the book Yoga Life now is.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so vital for people to, like you said, I mean, if you had not figured out how to fit yoga into the life that you had at that time, you wouldn't have had yoga at all. And that is just the reality of life sometimes. I mean, I think everybody just goes through ebbs and flows like this, whether they are externally imposed, like what you went through, or whether there's some internal shift that we're going through. And like, my practice changes all the time still. And I just am so grateful for it. I'm so grateful that I was actually taught this very early on by my teacher, Sarah Powers, that it is meant to be adaptable. And actually, Jason is the person who taught me that I was allowed to do poses that I loved in my home practice. I always felt like, oh, I should be working on, I should be sitting with discomfort more. I should be holding things for longer. Should. And he was like, just start by doing what you want, but what you love, what you want to do. And you kind of have a related concept in your book, your soulmate poses.
Yes.
So can you talk about what that means and then how you identify them?
Yes. Your soulmate poses, I define them as the poses that usher you into a flow state the fastest and the most efficiently, mainly by deepening your breath. So what I invite everyone listening to think about is like, what are those poses that when you do them, you find yourself breathing deeper quite quickly. So an example for me would be cat-cow, right? Sufi grind, which is from the Kundalini yoga tradition, is another one. Like, those are poses, because the thing that I also really harp on in the book is that the poses are empty vessels without the breath. It's the breath that's, you know, really giving you the nervous system regulation. It's the breath that's going to, you know, how deeply you're breathing is going to dictate how you feel at the end of a practice. So when I had that like really little time to practice, I was really trying to figure out like, how do I get into a deep breathing state as quickly as possible? Which in a traditional group class, I mean, because I found it often rambled, right, to get there. But when I was just like, you know what, I'm going to hone in on these soulmate postures, these ones that I know get me doing those deep diaphragmatic breaths or linking breath and movement in a really powerful way. I also invite you to think when your soulmate postures of ones that incorporate essential spinal movement, right? And cat-cow is like a classic example of that. So what I found is that if I was able to put those in first, it's almost like I got more bang for my yoga buck, right? It's like I was getting more out of the practice in less time because I was prioritizing those poses that helped me enter into a flow state through deep breathing faster. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, completely. That is really the key, I think. So we've got our soulmate poses. And I think the other thing that's so nice that you, I feel like I want to buy this book for all of my friends who do yoga in the studio and feel like when they don't have time to go to the studio, there's no yoga at all. Because you also have a really clear and concise framework. Can you kind of talk through that a little bit?
Yeah. And I love what you just said about the studio, because obviously we love the studio, but there's moments in life, whether you're caring for elderly parents or just had a baby or are sick or life is happening and you can't make it. And I think what we need in those instances is what I call the skill of yogic adaptability.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is even very advanced yoga teachers that I'd talked to didn't have this skill, right? If you were like, you have 10 minutes and a cold floor,
mm-hmm.
Between two activities, do yoga, like they just think it's not worth it, right?
Or they
wouldn't know what to practice, mm-hmm. right? And so with necessity being the mother of invention and being so desperate to fit yoga in, and that's where the habits from the book come in as well, like just sprinkling yoga in, even if it's just here and there between other activities, or sprinkling the philosophy into how you're living your life, is so important. I think the framework that you're asking about is the personal ritual framework, which
yes.
starts with sit. So this is where in the book, we pick a pranayama technique that's going to be soothing for your personality. So the hypothesis I present in this book is that yoga was never meant to be practiced outside of its sister science, Ayurveda. Probably everyone listening to this podcast knows what Ayurveda is, but mm-hmm. just in case, it's a healing modality from ancient times that, you know, it encompasses a wide variety of health and healing practices. It's best known for nutrition, but it operates under the idea that all of us are governed by nature and that we have three primary elements, one of which is most prevalent within us. So you either have a dominance of fire within your system, of earth, or of air. And I do a quiz at the beginning of the book. The book has tons of quizzes because I love quizzes and making it simple for folks. But the quiz at the top is kind of to help you figure out which is your dominant element, because then I hypothesize or I propose that, you know, if we look at the etymology of that word dosha, dosha actually translates to mean that which can cause problems, that which can skew out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And like attracts like. So that's why when I didn't have awareness, high pitta me chose Bikram yoga, right? Mm-hmm. So I always like to tell people the style of yoga you're attracted to initially is probably not the one that's going to bring you into balance.
Mm-hmm.
And then the wisdom of Ayurveda works with the idea of cultivate the opposite. So once you know your dominant dosha, you can actually start figuring out pretty quickly what breathing techniques and poses are going to serve to balance me. And which are maybe ones that I might want to avoid or that could pull me further out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sit section, we pick a pranayama technique that's going to be soothing for your dominant dosha. And I have the sit section first because you can do it anywhere. You can do it in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Because what's fun is after we make this little ritual in the book, we then disassemble it and tear it apart. And I'm like, okay, if you only have, you know, 10 minutes to practice, you just do section one and two. If you, you know, didn't sleep well and you have a plane to catch and your baby's teething, you know, here's how you'd make it 5 minutes. Or, you know, the entire house is clean and your family's on vacation and left you alone. Here's how you'd make it 60 minutes, right? So we kind of use the 20 minute to start, but it's completely modular and expandable and contractible. So we start with sit. Then we have warm up, which is where you want to insert those soulmate poses to kind of get in the zone. Then we have move is the next section, which is probably what most people would visualize when they think about yoga, maybe like those standing postures. But again, I invite you to choose standing postures or choose variations, adaptations of those standing postures through the sophisticated lens of what's going to balance my dominant element.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have stretch. The theme of that piece for me is really just less is more. For me, the mm-hmm. stretching section is more about emotional processing than it is trying to touch my toes. And then meditate is the last section. So people who've been through yoga teacher training, it's like, I think you can hang your hat on this. It's like, it follows in many ways a lot of what we've been taught about yoga sequencing, but it's very condensed. So like each of these things is, you know, 3 minutes or 4 minutes in this particular framework.
I think it's great. I mean, I just think you really, like, you touched on, for those who, even for those who teach classes, it can be sometimes hard to, when you don't have that whole amount of time to yourself, it can be hard to pick and choose and feel like you've gotten a complete practice. But when you touch on all of those elements that you've honed in on, you're going to have that complete experience regardless of the amount of time that you can spend.
Exactly. It's like the personalized practice is the most nourishing. I see personalization taking over everywhere, right? We have personalized medicine. We have personalized vitamins. I get the ads for the personalized shampoo. I don't know if you've seen those, mm-hmm. but I'm like, we need to bring this into yoga. And I talk about in chapter 3 of the book is like, this actually is the spirit of the original yoga, as you also commented on. Like, yoga was always meant to be personalized. Mm-hmm. So when we have this lens that the personalized practice, even if it's short, can be extremely potent, which is what mm-hmm. I experienced in that anecdote that I shared earlier and still is true for me and my body today. My goal is that, like, you see yourself rather than just a follower as sort of like this apothecarian, mm-hmm. right? So I visualize myself with like all these tinctures behind me, right? Bottles and elixirs. And then every morning, it's like I'm whipping up a yoga antidote for how I'm feeling, for mm-hmm. what I'm in the mood for the kind of day I have happening. Mm-hmm. So what we do in the book is we create that ritual framework. But then again, I help you deconstruct it. After we create it, I'm like, okay, you have this, but then what happens when you're tired, or what happens when you need energy, or what happens when you're on your period, or what happens when you're pregnant, or what happens when you're going through menopause, or what happens if you're in a season where you're experiencing high anxiety, right? And then it's like we can use that template of that 20 minutes, but then even further enhance it to kind of meet the moment that we're in, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's that yogic adaptability skill of being able to whip up a practice or a tincture that's really going to heal you and feel nourishing. That's a big reframe here, is that the practice is here to nourish you. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing those soulmate poses and you're practicing in a way that nourishes you, you don't want to skip your practice. So that's also how this becomes a love story, and you're able to get consistent instead of, you know, like that beating ourselves up that often happens. I know, because I have so many people ask me about how do I get consistent? And this is the answer. You just make your practice so pleasurable and adaptable that you'd never want to skip it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the other thing that's so nice about it, and you talk about self-awareness a lot in the book, or yoga awareness a lot, is that practicing this way both requires and helps you get to know yourself better, which is also just the essence of the yoga practice. It's like, in order to know how to whip up those tinctures, you have to experiment and figure out what your body and what your, like, you use the lens of Ayurveda, what your dosha requires on that day. And so it's to me, that's just such a potent part of practicing, is turning inward and, you know, generating that self-awareness. So love it. Totally valuable.
Love it.
Yeah.
But yeah, we love it.
Yeah, we love it. There's one more question I want to ask you about your book, and that is, I just love that you included meditation. I'm teaching meditation more and more, and I think meditation, just the word, can be so intimidating to people. So how do you make it less intimidating when you're talking about meditation with people?
Well, I always like to tell people who are new to meditation that meditation is the process of being willing to witness your mind. Mm-hmm. Yep. I know for a lot of us, for me, that's often as far as I get, right? Mm-hmm. We have these expectations that, you know, it's about quieting the mind, or it's about achieving nirvana, or like some otherworldly enlightenment. And really, I think the place we have to start is being willing to look, willing to witness the chatter of the mind that's maybe saying some of those imposter syndrome thoughts, or saying, I'm too late, like we talked about earlier, right? Mm-hmm. Can you sit with yourself and be with yourself while you watch that? And that's step one. And I break meditation into 3 steps. I have a meditation framework, and then I kind of show how you can tweak it for your dominant dosha. But that's step one, is the mm-hmm. willingness to witness. So I think that anytime I pause throughout my day to breathe and notice my thoughts, you know, kind of just step into witness consciousness, even if it's just for a moment, like, oh, I'm having a strong reaction to this email I just got. To me, that's yoga. Doesn't matter if I'm doing a pose or not. To me, that's yoga in the world, in life. So I think the more we can train the part of us that can witness the internal chatter without reacting to it, you know, that's meditation and that's worth doing. I talk about doing meditation in my garage with all the yoga habits, but you know, all of you can do that today as you go out throughout the world. It doesn't have to be seated on a cushion. It's just that moment of pause.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, the willingness, like that, it's a, that's a big piece of it, is just being willing to witness yourself.
It's a really hard ask, especially when mm-hmm. we have so many things designed to numb us, mm-hmm. right? Like our phone, mm-hmm. the television, right? Like so much of what's built into the fabric of our culture is mm-hmm. to just like anesthetize us, honestly, to not have to do that uncomfortable act of like being willing to witness, right? I can just scroll.
Yep. And it's like, so we're so also so conditioned to be hard on ourselves that sometimes when we take away all the distractions, all we're left with is this really harsh voice. And that's why it's so nice to have, you know, supportive teachers who can help you understand that that's normal, that's natural. You are not as bad as your mind is telling you to, you know, that you are. And just to cultivate that sense of self-compassion as you're willing to look, being self-compassionate with yourself as well.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the brain is wired to think binary. The brain is wired to protect us and catastrophize, right? It's preoccupied with our survival. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we got to love the brain. Thanks, brain.
Yeah.
But you know, that's what's so beautiful about yoga, right? It's helping us step into something bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks so much for being here, Brett. What else have you... So obviously, I'm going to put a link to your book on the show notes page so people can go out and get that. What else have you got going on these days, and where else can people find you?
Well, my website, brettlarkin.com, is the best place, with two T's, Brettlarkin. There's lots of courses, yoga online trainings, Kundalini training. I mean, everything under the sun, business courses. I really have so much content. And then, of course, YouTube is a great place to hang out. I also have my own podcast called The Uplifted Yoga Podcast. And the book, Yoga Life, is available everywhere books are sold.
You are awesome. Thanks so much, Brett. It's been great to meet you and talk to you. Thanks so much for sharing yourself with the yoga world and with Yoga Land.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I will put links to Brett's book and her trainings and her website at yogalandpodcast.com/episode324. And I will also include some past episodes with Nika Quisgard and Sarah Kucera. When Brett was talking about Ayurveda, I remembered I have some great past episodes that feature all kinds of information to help you understand Ayurveda from different perspectives. So I will link to those as well. Thanks as always, always, always for listening. I appreciate you so much. And until next week, enjoy your practice.